Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The NFL lockout is over, and the frenzied roster building has begun. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest offseason moves, including the trade of Washington defensive lineman Albert Haynesworth to New England.
Reading the newspaper in the meeting room, looking at his phone in the meeting room, falling asleep in the meeting room. He was easily the most disliked Redskins player that I have encountered in about a decade here.
Also ahead, what the loss of the annual Hall of Fame game means to Canton, Ohio, skateboarding's rise and fall and rise in the U.S., and an Egyptian squad serves up championship squash in the U.S. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Maybe the NFL should have a four-month lockout every year. Trades and free agent signings as the stopwatch ran and the musical chairs' music got louder have entertained fans for the past couple of days. And what fun it will be to see which teams turn out to have guessed wrong about whom to retain, discard, and acquire. Like poker players who elect to stand pat, the Panthers, Falcons, and Bucks have all spent lots of money to hold on to their current players. Cornerback Nnamdi Asamoah, perhaps the most sought-after of the free agents, was signed by Philadelphia for $60 million over 5 years. The Eagles also acquired Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie from Arizona. Matt Hasselbeck, 35, is among the veteran and very veteran quarterbacks on the move. Having spent the last 10 seasons with the Seattle Seahawks, he'll join the Tennessee Titans. Quarterback Kevin Cobb was traded from the Eagles to the Cardinals, where he has a $63 million contract, but money isn't everything. Chad Ochocinco got 86th by the Bengals, which may be the best thing that ever happened to him since he's joining the New England Patriots. More about that team's acquisitions later, but first, here's Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Mark Craig speculating on the acquisition by the Vikings of veteran quarterback Donovan McNabb and whether McNabb is a reclamation project.
Yeah, I mean, he falls along the lines of Randall Cunningham came here and had one of his best seasons when he was 35. Brett Favre came here and had arguably his best season when he was turned 40. And go back, you know, Warren Moon was an older, you know, probably in his late 30s, whenever he had some great years here in the mid-90s. So from the Vikings standpoint, it's kind of a win-win. You know, if he plays well enough to play a couple years, that's good. Christian Ponder can sit and learn. And if he doesn't, then, you know, they got the restructured deal, and it doesn't cost him a whole lot to say goodbye to him and start the Christian Ponder era.
It seems to me also that would be something that would appeal to fans. You know, let's root for the team that's giving the old guy another chance.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get any stranger than what happened with Brett Favre. You know, for 16, 18 years, he was about as hated as you could imagine at the Metrodome, and he came in and, you know, they really took to him in that 2009 season. And, you know, then last year their expectations were so high and the quarterback, the coach, the stadium, everything collapsed. I don't know that McNabb has been embraced. I think they'd probably be a month into the season before we get an idea how it's all going to work and whether or not he's got anything left.
Are fans in Minnesota likely to give him a month? Suppose he has two or three bad games at the start of the season. Is he going to hear a lot of booing?
Well, yeah, but you're talking about a guy who spent 11 years in Philadelphia. The Minnesota fans will be nothing for him.
When a Heisman Trophy winner changes teams, it's news, even if the guy has had to return the trophy. Reggie Bush scored 33 touchdowns during his 5 years with the New Orleans Saints, but he's missed lots of games with injuries. I asked Jeff Darlington, who covers the NFL for the Miami Herald, whether the Dolphins were gambling when they picked up Bush.
Well, it depends exactly what you believe you're gambling on. If you're looking for an every down back, that's a gamble. But if you're looking for a guy who can be a weapon, a real threat, and a playmaker on about 15 carries a game, you know, I think that that's a pretty good move. If you can keep him healthy, he's absolutely the kind of guy who could change a game for you.
You have suggested that Bush was acquired as much because he will sell tickets as because he will score touchdowns. How so?
Well, you know, I'm not suggesting that that's the reason for the acquisition, but I think it will most certainly make management happy. This is an organization that is struggling to sell season tickets. At one point, they even had a day where they had clearance tickets for like $250 for the season. So by bringing in a player that can provide a little bit of hope, and he's very familiar. I mean, look at his Twitter account, 1.8 million followers. I mean, this is not just a football player. It's a full-time celebrity.
The aforementioned Senor Ocho Cinco would be the most significant conversation starter among New England football fans if the Patriots hadn't also acquired the much-maligned Albert Haynesworth, late of the Redskins. Washington Post blogger Dan Steinberg has been chronicling Haynesworth's blunders. When I spoke with him, I mentioned that every account I'd read of Albert Haynesworth's departure sounded the same. Washington had jettisoned Haynesworth, or rid themselves of him, or ditched him. Was there anybody in Washington sorry to see him go?
I haven't encountered a single person. I can't imagine why anyone would have been. He was easily the most disliked Redskins player that I've encountered in about a decade here.
According to your recent column titled Albert Haynesworth's 10 Worst Redskins Moments, moments that took him only 2 years to accumulate, Mr. Haynesworth's teammates have considered him a problem rather than an asset. Why?
There are stories now about him reading the newspaper in the meeting room, looking at his phone in the meeting room, falling asleep in the meeting room, not paying attention, refusing to take notes. I mean, things like that are not going to go over very well with your teammates. But then, you know, there's the on-the-field stuff, too. Like when he, in the famous Monday night game against the Eagles, he kind of went down quickly during one play, and Michael Vick is scrambling around, and his teammates are kind of trying to, you know, run around him as if he's like a roadblock because he's just laying there in the middle of the field.
You've followed this guy's career for a couple of years now pretty closely. What's the likelihood that Albert Haynesworth can turn things around with the Patriots?
That's a great question, and people here are curious, and I think there's a little bit of dread. Bill Belichick obviously has a track record of helping some kind of controversial players, so you know, who knows? I mean, I'll tell you one game I think he's going to be an absolute monster. I think it's December 11th. The Patriots come to FedEx Field to play the Redskins. I can envision a scenario in which Haynesworth gets 17 sacks and knocks 13 Redskins players out of the game. Obviously, he's going to have, I mean, just a tremendous amount of motivation in that particular game. Whether he can do it for a full season, I don't know. But I think that he's got to be more productive than he was in Washington.
Maybe Haynesworth will be able to stay out of the media spotlight in New England because the Patriots are going to have Chad Ochocinco.
Yeah. It's true. They also have a track record of keeping guys kind of happy somehow, guys who have a history of unhappiness.
Will McNabb be the latest quarterback to rediscover his younger self in Minnesota? Will Bush blossom in Miami? Will Haynesworth show up for work in New England? When has anticipating the NFL season been such fun? Anyone else for annual lockouts? With the lockout over and players lining up to pass through training camp gates, it's been good times for football fans. That is, unless you're a fan of the annual Hall of Fame game in Canton, Ohio. That's where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is based, and some folks there think they're getting the raw end of the deal. Reporter Eric Wellman explains.
When NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell went on TV to announce the end of the lockout, this is what most of the country heard.
With this ratification, we will be prepared to open the training facilities beginning on Saturday.
Translation, there will be football. But if you lived in Canton, Ohio, this is the part of the commissioner's remarks you would have paid attention to.
We are unfortunately going to have to cancel the Hall of Fame game this year.
The Hall of Fame game has been an annual tradition in Canton for the past 45 years, capping 10 days of celebration of the Hall of Fame inductions. Chris Bevin is the sports editor at the Canton Repository. He says in the scope of the football season, this game isn't a big deal, but it means a lot to Northeast Ohio.
This is a big deal because it's the only, you know, professional football game that's played in Canton, Ohio at Fawcett Stadium, so that's a big point of pride. it almost always is the first game of the NFL season. Again, another point of pride for the people here that, you know, that really love their football.
But it's the economic impact that people here are most worried about. You see, the Hall of Fame game traditionally draws thousands of people to the city from across the country for days of festivities. But without the game, those fans might not come. The Hall of Fame is a nonprofit, and ticket sales from the game account for a big part of the hall's budget. Joe Horrigan is vice president of communications.
We have lost the revenue that we would have received from ticket sales for the game. There's merchandise sales that will not occur as a result. There's admissions to the Hall of Fame and Hall of Fame merchandise sales that would have occurred. And we know that the three-hour window of primetime television exposure is something that we'll feel through the course of a year, because we did feel the positive response that, you know, that people get from seeing that game annually.
In past years, the Hall of Fame has brought in more than $3 million in the week leading up to the inductions, a quarter of its budget. But Horrigan estimates this year half that money might not come in.
Well, we have been saying publicly that we think that it would be in $1 million to $1.5 million range. But, you know, again, we really won't know that. It could grow as we start seeing the effects as the events go on.
Thursday night was the big kickoff to the inductions week with a free concert in downtown Canton. Many people here expressed frustration that the city was getting a bad deal.
We look forward to this every year.
Joanne Adams sits on a camping chair feet from the stage. She watches the game every year, either on TV or in person.
You know, it's something that the city of Canton really had nothing to do with, okay? But these people, you know, the NFL or whoever they are, you know, as big as they are, they made that decision, you know, and it is what it is.
Lonnie McHenry of nearby Massillon says she doesn't much care for the game. Preseason football, she says, isn't her thing. But McHenry worries about the local merchants who are likely to miss out on the big boost in tourism.
Especially the way the economy is now, you know, all the help you can get, you need.
At the Hall of Fame, fan reaction is somewhat different. Jim Mitchell brought his family up from Richmond, Virginia, and he was hoping to take in a football game.
Well, we definitely wanted to see the game. We're disappointed there's not going to be a game, but it's good enough for us just to get inside and check everything out.
Chris Marcus came to the Hall of Fame from Dayton, Ohio.
I didn't even know it existed, so no. I don't start paying attention until about till the real season starts.
His son, Austin, also isn't losing any sleep.
I didn't know it existed until it was canceled.
So you're not broken up over it?
No.
Game or no game, the Hall of Fame celebrations go on. Former stars including Deion Sanders and Marshall Faulk will be inducted. Chris Bevan, the newspaper editor, says the Hall of Fame is ultimately going to be okay.
There's no sense for them to sit and point fingers. It happened, and you got to deal with it and move on. And I think they're hopeful that the Hall of Fame enshrinement itself obviously will be center stage this weekend, even more so than any other year, and they'll probably try to make that the best enshrinement they can.
The NFL has a history of giving the Hall of Fame a hand financially, and some sports writers think the league may pitch in a few bucks to help offset this year's loss. But thanks to the 10-year deal the players struck with the owners, Canton will be hosting many more Hall of Fame games down the road. For Only a Game, I'm Eric Wellman.
Give me a chance and I'll try to please. I've done you wrong. I've treated you bad. You're the best gal that I've ever had. And if you give me another chance, won't do it again.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The official match ball for soccer games at the 2012 London Olympics will be called the Albert in order to honor the form of East End London Cockney slang in which an object is referred to by a name that rhymes with it once removed. The Albert refers to London's Albert Hall, and hall rhymes with ball, so ball is Albert. I wonder if this means a match will be called a hall, since game rhymes with fame, and soccer, like most sports, has a Hall of Fame. And the site of the games could be called the Fridge, since fridge rhymes with bridge, as in London Bridge. This is kind of fun, but I'm glad it's over, as in overdone, over for done. Wait, that worked so well it didn't. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the thrills and spills of the sport in which a 13-year-old can be the best in the world until his foot explodes. But first, it's time to talk about a more lyrical and pastoral game with our baseball guy, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. On Tuesday night, the Braves beat the Pirates in a 19-inning game that ended when umpire Jerry Meals called Atlanta's Julio Lugo safe on a play at the plate. Everybody else in the building thought Lugo was out, and the next day, Mr. Meals acknowledged that they were right. Do you draw any conclusions about the place of video technology and replay in baseball from that game?
I really don't think so, Bill. That was a big call in a big game, and if that call had come in a postseason game or affected an entire postseason series, I think that would be the impetus to get expanded replay. But again, it's not that simple. I mean, it's not as simple as, hey, we could fix everything just by doing this. You're messing with the fabric of the game. Now, if someone can explain to me a quick, concise, foolproof way to do this, and then you have to explain all the ramifications that if you make a call and then it's overturned and then you have to tell us where the runners are being placed. There are some thorny issues that people are not examining. I'm behind replay now because umpires themselves have told me we don't want to be wrong, and everyone in the building has a replay that we don't have. And if we can make a quick, concise way to do it, I'm for it, but explain it to me first.
This week, Irvin Santana of the Angels became the third guy to throw a no-hitter this season. Would you agree that the most curious thing about that particular no-hitter was that until the top of the fifth inning, the guy who threw it looked as if he might lose the game?
Yes, and the other curious thing, Bill, was the line score from that game for the Cleveland Indians. One run, zero hits, five errors. I checked, because this is what I do. There's never been a game in baseball history, and we're talking 195,000 games or so, in which we've seen that line score. Team scored a run, didn't get a hit, made five errors. It was ridiculous. And yes, I thought for a while there Santana was going to lose that game. Thankfully, I guess he won, but that's the first time since 1993 with Darrell Kyle that a pitcher pitched a no-hitter and allowed a run.
Tim, do you have a stable of interns that figure all these things out for you and look them up, or is it all just on a series of computers there at ESPN?
Bill, it's just me having nothing else to do with my life. I have no hobbies. I have no interest whatsoever. I love my children and my family. Otherwise, I don't have anything else to do. So I tend to look things up, and yes, we, of course, get a lot of help on these things, but somebody's got to ask the question first, mm-hmm. And I asked, has anyone ever gone 105 in a no-hitter? And the answer is no, they haven't.
On Wednesday night, the Seattle Mariners beat the Yankees following 17 consecutive Seattle losses. Were you more surprised that the Mariners lost 17 games in a row or that they beat the Yankees?
I was surprised by the whole thing because the Mariners surprised me every single day. The day before, Bill, they became the second team in Major League history to get one hit in a game and strike out 18 times. Second time in the history of baseball. It's unbelievable. And then they go out and get 17 hits against the Yankees and win. But the most amazing thing about this losing streak is it began when the Mariners were 43-43, which suggest they were a decent team, and then they went on to lose 17 games in a row. That might be the worst hitting team I think I've ever seen.
The San Francisco Giants acquired Carlos Beltran from the Mets this week. Does this suggest to you that the Mets have pretty much written off the season?
Yes, and they should write off the season because they're simply not good enough to catch the Braves or the Phillies in that division. Having said that, they have had a very successful year so far. To be above 500 at this point is, in a word, surprising, if not shocking. And the way they've played under their new manager, Terry Collins, has been really interesting to watch. They've really played well. But they didn't have a choice with Francisco Rodriguez, who had an option coming up. They had to move him. And Carlos Beltran wasn't coming back next year anyway. They had to move him. The key now is, of course, keeping David Wright around and re-signing Jose Reyes, their spectacular shortstop. That's where all this money that they're saving on Beltran and Frankie Rodriguez, that's going towards signing Jose Reyes long-term. No guarantee that they will, but they have to give it a shot.
All right, Tim, I've been holding off talking about the Red Sox, but it does seem worth mentioning that Boston started off so badly in April that ESPN was saying things like, no team that's ever been this bad at the beginning of the season has ever managed to come back and contend. What happened to turn this team around?
Well, by the way, ESPN used the panic meter with me several times with the Red Sox after six games of a 162-game season. What is the panic meter on the Red Sox? I almost resigned that day. It was so ridiculous. But the reason that they've turned it around for several reasons. First off, their pitching's been way better than it was last year, led by Josh Beckett, who got hammered last year and has been an all-star this year. But most important, they have had a healthy offense. Jacoby Ellsbury, who missed basically all last year, is now an MVP candidate with the season he's had. They traded for Adrian Gonzalez. He's still hitting around 350. They're going to the playoffs, and the panic meter that I set on a 1, I probably should have set it on a 0.
Okay, you've had a little more than half a season to gather impressions. Which teams thrive from here until late September, and which one wins the World Series?
Well, I think the Red Sox and Yankees make the playoffs from the East. I think the Tigers win the Central. I think the Rangers win the West. And I think the Red Sox win the pennant in the American League. I think the Phillies and Braves make it from the National League East. I think the Cardinals somehow are going to win the Central, and I think the Giants will win the West. I think the Phillies are going to beat the Giants for the National League pennant. They're going to play the Red Sox in the World Series, and I think the Red Sox are going to beat the Phillies. And that's exactly how I picked it at the beginning of the year, and if I'm right about all this, it will be a miracle.
And will this mean that ESPN will, in fact, shut down the panic meter forever?
I would hope so. Otherwise, they're going to just shut me down because I'm not doing any more panic meters six games into the season.
Tim Kirkchian covers baseball for ESPN and talks to me about it on some of my best days. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
It's not true that there's no such thing as an old skateboarder. It is true that there's no such thing as an old skateboarder who hasn't broken a lot of bones. Some of the younger ones are seriously banged up as well. Those are two of the things I learned from Cole Lewison's new book, The Impossible, subtitled Rodney Mullen, Ryan Scheckler, and the Fantastic History of Skateboarding. As the X Games are currently in progress in Los Angeles, it seems appropriate for Cole Lewison to join me now from WXXI in Rochester, New York, which he does. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much.
I'm going to start with a statistic that I found in a footnote on page 84 of your book. It says that somebody named Danny Way once rode a skateboard at 74.5 miles an hour. Is that a typo?
It's not. Danny's a breaker of skate records. He jumped the wall, Great Wall of China, on his skateboard, and he did, and decided he wanted to be the person who'd been the fastest on a skateboard. So he put on sort of this, like, Evel Knievel-looking suit and built a special board basically out of, like, airplane parts, and then they built him this special little weird car that had a thing sticking out of it that he held on to.
So it was with motorized assistance.
Yes, it was.
In chronicling the history of skateboarding, you found that the sport, and I'm quoting again now, is full of neglected, abused, manic, and unnurtured people. Why is that?
That's a very good question, and it sounds sort of negative, and it's really not. It does attract people who I guess sort of don't fit in to other sports or maybe art forms or are a little more solitary. Rodney Mullen, who I focused on, had said that to me in one of our interviews. He said, I've always felt like an outsider, but what skater doesn't feel like an outsider? And that's the beauty of skating, is it's a collection of people who don't belong in collections.
One of the distinctions of skateboarding is that some of the sport's greatest competitors have accepted sponsorships when they were exceptionally young, like 10 or 11. How did that become the accepted pattern in skateboarding?
I think it's similar, like the kind of the closest thing that I could find to it was not really in other sports. It was in almost like now and then you find a kid who has some deep hard wiring to play music. Or, you know, is maybe, like, really good at math. The other guy in the book, Ryan Scheckler, he was 2 years old when his parents said he found this skateboard in the garage, and he was obsessed. That's all he wanted to do all the time. And Rodney, the older guy, when he first saw Scheckler skate, he said, yeah, it's just hardwired. He has it in a Mozart way, where it's a natural thing. And Ryan and then his other kind of contemporary, Nyjah Houston, were both like that. And Ryan has this thing where he's always been really competitive. He wanted to enter contests. His parents finally let him enter one when he was 7 years old, and he won. And he just kept skating. He entered his first pro contest when he was 10 years old and won that.
So I'm a little bit surprised by that answer, because I expected you to say, well, you know, normal people, by the time they get to be about, 16 or 17, look around and say, holy cow, what am I doing risking my life with this?
I don't know. It's really hard when it's taken away from them. Ryan, a couple of years ago, he was winning contests with this full-arm black brace. He would be out there skating because he had broke his arm yet again, but just wanted to keep competing. The risks and the pain and the injuries they're worth it for, I guess, what these guys take out of it.
One of the complaints that I've heard about the sport is that the companies that sponsor the athletes demand ever more spectacular and dangerous tricks, which result in ever more serious injuries. Is that a fair criticism of skateboarding?
Yeah, I think it is fair, especially because it's in that category of extreme sports. You know, that's what made Tony Hawk a superstar back in 1995 when he was, you know, first on ESPN and was at a real low point in his life. Visually, I mean, he was just so stunning. He was 20 feet up in the air, upside down with, you know, 1 foot on his skateboard. And that just draws people in. And so skaters like Danny Way, who holds the speed record, they want to keep pushing. Ryan Scheckler is not a ramp guy, but he does things like skate off a two-story balcony, which is why he's broken his elbow 10 times. So I think there's definitely a momentum towards more extreme, bigger, better, and also more dangerous, because that's also more captivating.
As I was reading your book, I often came across a sentence like, you should see this guy skate, or something to that effect. And often the book refers to specific videos or websites where you can find the tricks of Ryan Scheckler and others. What led you to write a book about something that perhaps can only be fully appreciated when we see it rather than read about it?
Well, I don't know. I guess skateboarding is something I already knew a lot about and liked a lot and had done as a kid, and I still cruise around. Part of it was, to me, skating is very beautiful. It's a very hard athletic thing, hence all the broken bones, but it's also an incredibly graceful thing that's all about balance and movement. And just to see things like Rodney does a trick in the book, he's the only one in the world who can do it, called a switch stance kickflip 1 foot nose.
I'm sorry, man, that is a great name.
Yeah, that was kind of the challenge, was I would like to tell people about this interesting thing that's also, you know, it's uniquely American. It's only 50 years old, but it makes almost as much money as the NFL, and it's very beautiful, and trying to break down these movements so people could see it frame by frame and maybe have a greater understanding of, you know, the beauty and the danger and the intensity of it all.
Cole Lewison is the author of The Impossible, Rodney Mullen, Ryan Scheckler, and the Fantastic History of Skateboarding. It's published by Lions Press, and Cole Lewison spoke to me from WXXI in Rochester, New York. Cole, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Try the impossible. Try to understand the way I feel about you. Try the incredible. For in trying.
You're listening to Only a Game. Winning isn't everything, and it isn't the only thing. It's one of many things. Joan Benoit Samuelson said that. In a sense, that's ironic, not only because Ms. Samuelson won an Olympic gold medal, the Boston Marathon, and various other elite races, but because she has remained competitive several decades later. But I've found myself thinking about what this accomplished and thoughtful athlete said this summer as I've watched a couple of soccer games. The first saw Spain's national team humble the U.S. team in an exhibition preceding the Gold Cup tournament in June. I sat in the press box in Foxborough, Massachusetts for that one and listened to various U.S. writers second guess U.S. coach Bob Bradley, who was fired this week. The writers grumbled about Bradley's starting lineup and his substitutions and his tactics. Maybe they hammered him for his haircut, too. If so, that happened after I'd moved to a different seat from which I could appreciate in peace the game the Spanish team was playing. They showed anyone who wasn't grumbling how patience and imagination combined with skill can produce art. Afterward, Santiago Cazorla, who scored two of his team's four goals, was asked if it had been easy. He said it had not been, which is a credit to him, but it is also true. Learning and practicing a system is challenging, and the triumph of the hard work is making the result look natural, even easy. Like the U.S. national team against Spain, Major League Soccer's All-Stars came up short when they faced Manchester United on Wednesday night. Way short. But again, winning wasn't the point, or at least it wasn't the only point. It was one of many things. Both games were exhibitions. Both exhibitions were filled with exquisite moments of balance and creativity. Lots of MLS fans may have been dismayed when Man U's Park Ji-sung danced just far enough past two defenders who had him sandwiched to tuck the ball home. But if, shortly thereafter, they didn't smile at the midfielder's elegant moves, they shortchanged themselves. It was the sort of sequence bound to delight anyone who appreciates the possibilities of the game, which is one of those many things. On Thursday, the U.S. Soccer Federation announced that Jurgen Klinsmann will succeed Bob Bradley as coach of the U.S. team. He'll be in charge when the U.S. plays Mexico a week from Wednesday, the first game between the CONCACAF rivals since Mexico eliminated the U.S. in the Gold Cup final. Lots of fans will see that friendly as the beginning of Klinsmann's attempt to develop a team that can excel during qualifying for the 2014 World Cup. And that is one of the many things that game will be. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
The 1,500-meter race at the Monaco Diamond League on July 22nd demonstrated that if you're only watching the winner, you might miss the real excitement. At the end of the race, French teammates Mehdi Bala, who finished 9th, and Mehadina Makisi Benabad, who finished 11th, moved toward each other, apparently to offer consolation. But the next thing anybody knew, Bala had delivered a headbutt to Makisi Benabad, who responded with several wild punches. The two clashed again after they were separated, at which point Makisi appeared to slap Bala, who told him, "I'm going to break you in two." We have been unable to confirm the rumor that both men have been offered contracts in the WWE. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Egypt squashes everybody at squash, or at least the young women from there do. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL lockout is history, and everybody seems to be ready for some football. How about you?
Oh, I'm ready to go. I mean, I've got a very interesting football team here locally now, much more interesting than it was 2 days ago.
Well, at least in terms of personality slash celebrities. Well, tell us a little about that.
Well, first of all, the more mellow of the two acquisitions, wide receiver Chad Ochocinco, last seen riding bulls, and last seen prior to that trying out for professional soccer, is coming to join his old BFF, Bill Belichick. And then they double down on the possible insanity by bringing in Albert Hainsworth, who's the least popular person in Washington this side of John Boehner.
This week there's been some indication that fans are willing to pay more money than ever to attend games. Do you think this is because the lockout made everyone imagine what life would be like without the NFL?
I think that's not an unreasonable supposition. I think, honestly, that a lot of people saw life without football and panicked. The most expensive games, like, according to what is described in the story as a secondary market ticket aggregator, Scalper. Excuse me. Again, common sense caught in my throat there for a minute, is the January 1st game with the Giants and the Cowboys. Neither of which teams is particularly good, but they are both national teams, so they both draw a big price.
In college football news, Butch Davis was fired as UNC head football coach this week. Defensive coordinator Everett Withers has been named interim coach. Can we say that the house, or at least the sports wing of the house at UNC, has been thoroughly cleaned?
Well, they also got rid of the athletic director, Dick Bedour. They've cleaned out the Augean stables as best they can. This is a school that is primarily known, and its athletics is primarily financed by its basketball team. I have a feeling that the school will take its time putting its football team back on the rails.
Boise State players have been told they can't wear their blue uniforms at home games this season. Why not?
Because apparently, according to the officials of the Mountain West Conference, who have had very little to do this summer, they're afraid that the Boise State players blend into their blue football field.
Camouflage. They'll disappear. All right, now two pro basketball stories that I will ask you to consider jointly. Number one, basketball-related income and total player compensation each increased by 4.8% in the NBA during the past season. And number two, the players have been locked out by the owners.
Because the previous expense is too high for the owners who have the power to lock out the players, basically.
Simple.
There you go.
Kevin Love of the Minnesota Timberwolves has come up with an excellent way to stay in shape during the lockout, don't you think?
He wants to play beach volleyball, figuring, and not without reason, that it will be more fun to hang around on the beach with bikini-clad fellow athletes than going to Turkey in some smoky hall and sweating and playing basketball. And you have to remember, it's in his blood, because his uncle was a member of the Beach Boys.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's got that music sports connection
absolutely.
Going here on Only a Game. Kobe Bryant is in Istanbul this weekend to explore the possibility of playing for a team there during the NBA lockout. So maybe Kobe and OJ Mayo can earn some bread over there in Turkey.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote that. It wasn't me.
And how happy will the fans in Istanbul be? They'll be Turkish delight.
It just goes on and on. For a while on Wednesday night, Major League Soccer's All-Stars handled themselves pretty well against Manchester United. And after that game, Man U's Wayne Rooney even said that he thought soccer in the U.S. was getting better. So, you think he was just being polite?
He was being polite. Major League Soccer All-Stars lost 4-0, which might as well, as you know, be 16-0. Of course, again, you've got a real team against an all-star team, Bill, so maybe things are looking up.
Team games do tend to reward people that play together as a team. FIFA, that bastion of respectability, announced this week that the Caribbean soccer officials implicated in a bribery scheme would have 48 hours to explain everything, and if they failed to do so, they would be, quote, subject to a full range of sanctions. So, do you suppose FIFA will be bringing out the soft cushions?
I think they're giving them 48 hours to come up with more money myself. I hate to do that. I hate to do this, but this, another headline. This is from SI.com. FIFA gives last chance to bribery suspects. Last chance to what?
Bribe.
More money. More money, more money.
Ultimate Fighting champ Tito Ortiz had some advice for youngsters this week, Charlie. Now, I'm not sure said youngsters should be taking all their cues from Ultimate Fighting champions, but in this case, they probably should pay attention to Mr. Ortiz, right?
Yes, he dented his Rolls-Royce Phantom because he was texting while driving.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently shed not a few tears over the fender bender. It was going very fast. The damage he's done to his Phantom has convinced him that texting and driving is a bad thing to do, kids.
Tiger Woods says that he will play in next week's Bridgestone Invitational. He has not played since May 12th, citing the need to be completely healthy. So look out, Darren Clark, et al.?
No. I'll believe this when I see it. I'll believe he's playing on Sunday when he's playing on Sunday.
An accomplished pro golfer can, of course, make a lot of money whether or not he wins tournaments. And as Dustin Johnson, who came up just short at the 2010 U.S. Open, the 2010 PGA Championship, and the 2011 British Open, has demonstrated, he can also branch out into other lucrative fields.
Yeah, good for him. He's put a T-shirt that says, "What bunker?" on it. He fell out of a playoff at the PGA last year for grounding his club in a bunker because he didn't realize it was a bunker. You remember this? It looked, in fact, like something left behind by a truck that had backed up.
Yeah, exactly. Like a dirt road is what it looked like.
So he's got now a T-shirt that says, "What bunker?" And good for him. I hope he makes a fortune on it.
And finally, Charlie, we have another world record to celebrate. And this one was
Sports!
I wondered if I'd even get to the middle of the second sentence. Anyway, this record was set at the home of the last place San Diego Padres, so it was a cinch. It had nothing to do with baseball, right?
Yes, the most dogs in a pet costume parade. 337 dogs showed up dressed in costumes. None of them dressed up, however, as competent Major League Baseball players.
Is this another of those bottomless wells of one-liners you talk about?
I got a million of them, and not all of them are bad.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books. His story about Adrian Gonzalez grabbed the cover of the Boston Sunday Globe magazine this week, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Tonight, after nearly 2 weeks of play, the Women's World Junior Squash Championships will conclude with the team finals. Only a Game's Doug Trabu has been covering the tournament.
Quick, think of three things you associate with Egypt. Okay, what'd you come up with? Pyramids, the Sphinx, maybe King Tut or the Nile River? Here's one you probably missed, the sport of squash. The squash players gathered at the Murr Center in Harvard University's athletic complex in Boston were originally supposed to meet in Cairo. There are 79 players representing 19 nations in this year's Women's World Junior Squash Championship, an 11-day event featuring both the annual individual and biannual team championships. The World Squash Federation moved the event to the U.S. after the Egyptian Revolution began on January 25th. Steve Cubbins runs SquashSite, the world's leading squash website. Although unrest in Cairo affected squash events in Egypt throughout the spring, Cubbins says things are returning to normal, and the city is still one of the sport's strongest hubs.
2 years ago, I went to Cairo for a junior event, and I was amazed that we had a tournament like this that ran six courts, 9 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. Matches finished. We were all relieved. Then hundreds of kids just came in and started playing until midnight. That's the thing. They're just mad about it.
World Squash Federation Chief Executive Andrew Shelley says the women's game has grown dramatically in Egypt and around the globe.
If you went back 15 years and before, England, Australia, New Zealand, that was it. Obviously a smattering of other players, but that was it. The world number one now is Malaysian. We have very strong players from France, from Netherlands, from Hong Kong.
Squash, tennis, and racquetball are cousins. But as U.S. junior women's coach Jack Wyan explains, there are a number of differences.
The squash ball does not bounce nearly as much as the racquetball. So even though our court is slightly smaller than a racquetball court, you tend to have to cover more of the court. So it's a physically very grueling sport.
Harvard's Murr Center includes a row of five courts with bleachers behind them. The courts don't have ceilings, and the back walls are tempered glass to allow for easy viewing. The Women's World Junior Championship is for players under the age of 19, but this year's field includes some of the best female squash players of any age. The Women's International Squash Players Association ranks five of the teams here among the top 40 players in the world. One of them is 18-year-old Amanda Sobey. The Seacliff, New York resident, ranked 21st overall, is this event's defending champ. She only started playing about 5 years ago.
I was playing tennis at the time, but I'd always end up being at squash tournaments, so I'd just pick up a racket and hit a ball. And people said, wow, you're pretty good for just not playing at all. And so I started playing squash and tennis in between, but since the swings are different, it was I couldn't play both. So my dad told me either become really good at tennis or become really good at squash, and I chose squash.
Squash runs deep in the Sobey family. Her parents met at a tournament her mother was running. Sobey's father, Khaled, is originally from Egypt and was a top junior player and a member of the national team there. Amanda's older brother is a collegiate player, and her younger sister, Sabrina, is also on the U.S. women's junior team.
Can you beat your dad?
That happened a long time ago.
Was he surprised when you beat him, or did he know it was coming?
He knew it was coming. Now, he's just trying to keep the reins on my little sister.
Amanda will soon be a familiar face on the courts at Harvard. She'll be a student here this fall. Despite her family ties to Egypt, Sobey was glad to see the tournament moved to the U.S.
I've been to Egypt pretty much every summer since I was 7, so I know that there'll be tons and tons of Egyptians there rooting for the Egyptians. So it was nice that we were able to get it to the U.S., because now there's going to be tons and tons of Americans cheering for us. But it's a shame that it had to be moved because of what happened in Egypt.
Amir Waghi has been the Egyptian national coach for 12 years and has guided male and female teams and players to 18 world titles. Waghi says he was glad the tournament was relocated.
I think outside of Egypt is much better for me because it's out of the pressure, because if it's in Egypt, also it's big pressure on you, so it's good we play in U.S. this year.
Organizers have already announced the men's and women's junior championships will both be held in Cairo in 2012. This year's tournament has attracted teams from traditional squash strongholds like England, Germany, and France. But teams from countries where the sport is still developing are here too. Keisha Jeffrey plays for the South American nation of Guyana.
I'm 18 years old, and I've been playing squash since I was about 7 years old. But where I'm from, squash isn't that big. We have, like, about 3 courts in the whole country, so, yeah.
So it's a little tough to get a game?
It's a little tough to get anything out of squash in Guyana, but we try. We have a really good coach, one coach, actually, one elite coach for the whole country, so it's good. We all have to share him.
Jessica Turnbull is from Brisbane, Australia. She's 16, and this is her first time at this event. Turnbull says everyone's friendly, but facing top players can be intimidating.
It's scary. It's exciting. It's amazing. It's embarrassing sometimes. Just when, you know, you do something really stupid against someone really good, and you just feel, oh, my God, what did you just do? And like, oh, it's like that. And you're just feeling so embarrassed, and you're embarrassed for the rest of the tournament. It's just like, oh, no.
Although the United States has the second seed in both the individual and team brackets, it's not typically a squash powerhouse. In fact, the U.S. is a growth market for the sport. U.S. Squash Communications Director Bill Buckingham says the emergence of top American teens like Amanda Sobey and Olivia Blatchford coincides with dramatic changes at the junior level.
Our high school championships started out with 15 teams 6 years ago. For the last 3 years, it's been the largest squash tournament in the world, capping off at 125 teams this year. The growth in scholastic squash has been great. The growth in collegiate squash has been incredible.
After 4 days of matches, the field was whittled down to the 4 semifinalists: England's Emily Whitlock, Amanda Sobey for the U.S., and Egyptian teammates Nour El Tayeb and Nour El Shabini. While most of the earlier matches have been played on regular courts, the semifinals shift to one with all glass walls. When a player hits a full force shot, it sounds like a bird hitting a plate glass window. In the end, the two Nours advanced to Monday night's individual final. Nour El Shabini won this tournament in 2009 at the age of 13, beating the same opponent she'll face tonight, her teammate Nour El Tayeb. El Tayeb is ranked 18th in the world and has been the runner-up for the past 2 years. This time around, El Tayeb is victorious, beating El Shabini in 4 games. El Tayeb says it's tough to face a teammate and friend in a high-pressure match.
She's been the world champion before. She has nothing to lose. She plays with no pressure. And it's hard, you know.
I wanted to win, but of course I want me to win as well, but it was hard all the way, and I'm happy. I'm really happy I won.
Egyptian women have four of the last seven junior team titles, and now five of the past six individual crowns. After winning major points during the final match, the 18-year-old El Tayeb delivered an exclamation American sports fans are used to hearing.
I always yell yes.
Wherever you are.
Yeah, wherever, yes. Wherever I am.
And the individual awards ceremony concluded with something squash fans around the world are getting used to hearing, the Egyptian national anthem. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Allison Gluck. We had help this week from Andrew Croucher at WXXI in Rochester, New York. Special thanks this week to Paul Vitkus. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Doug Tribou's squash photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from U.S. squash team member Olivia Fichter, who cites one of the major benefits of playing the sport.
I love my, like, junk food and stuff, and it's just awesome. I can go, you know, have fun playing it and also still work off all my snacks.
Well, it's a good thing Olivia's into squash and not, say, baseball or sumo wrestling. Athletes in those sports never work off their snacks. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
No, I'm not trying to fool you.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.